Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and today I'm delighted and honored to have really my friends, Art Spiegelman and Françoise Mouly, together in the studio. They have produced the first number of what will be a series of books of comics for kids under the title Little Lit. And this first issue is devoted to folklore and fairy tale funnies. It's by every artist that you would want to see. This is an anthology. They have edited it. And we have William Joyce in here, as well as Art Spiegelman. Some of the best people that you can think of, both from the world of children's books and underground comics. And, well, I guess my first question is this for kids or for adults? Any adult would want it, but so would any child, and everyone wants to snatch it from me.
I think one of the standard lines is genuinely appropriate here, which has to do with it's for all ages. I would exempt only kids when their hormones first kick in, perhaps, and all they're interested in is a strong hip-hop beat and the most banal part of popular culture that might travel them through their teenage years, which are a stormy time, successfully. But I would say up until that moment, one could start at the age of 3 sitting on a lap and having these stories told to you as you point from panel to panel. It's ideal for kids who are just learning to read, which is what was the initial impulse. And presumably, the idea was not at all to talk past kids to the grown-ups who could sneak a picture book out of the bookstore and enjoy it, but talk to everybody, the kid on the lap, the adult who's holding the kid on the lap, and just make it enjoyable for all.
One of the definition for me is for anybody who loves books. And I noticed when I was a child myself, and suddenly when our kids started being read to and looking through books, that there's so many pleasures in reading, and one of them is a tactile pleasure, it's an object. So we wanted this to be a beautiful object. And the visual element of it is to give you this satisfaction of reading a book, even when you're pre-literate.
What Françoise and I both realized is that we learn to read from reading comic books. Our kids learn to read from reading comic books. You probably read more than anybody I've ever met in my entire life. And you probably learned to read from reading comic books, or could well have if you didn't.
Well, what I like about this is that many of us have grown up on comic books, and so we still look at the more interesting developments in comic books. But the young kids, you know, they still have Archie, maybe.
Maybe. And that's the thing. One of the things we put on the back cover is comics, they're not just for grown-ups anymore. Because at one time, there were comic books for very little kids. And by God, I used to have some until my kids got hold of them. Now that I have shreds of comic books that were once popular items. And most of their friends, when they come over, love seeing these things, like Little Lulu comics and the Walt Disney comics and Walt Kelly's old comic books for kids. But the kids who might be interested in comics don't see them. They're not in every mom-and-pop shop anymore. They're, at best, like these little digest-sized Archie comics that they'll find at the checkout counter. Or you have to go into this real rarefied area of the specialty shop to find a superhero comic that's really geared for collectors. And it's no longer the popular culture it once was, giving easy mm-hmm. access to books directly for kids.
My guests are Art Spiegelman and Françoise Mouly, who have edited Little Lit. And I want to give the listener a sense of what this book is and contains. To some extent, Art and Françoise are the parents of Little Lit and the parents of the artists in Little Lit, because many of them are people that they've nurtured from the days when they edited a book of comics that were more or less for adults called Raw. These comics are called Raw Junior books. That's the series that Art and Françoise are putting together. And I liked something that Art had told me about whether these people, these particular artists, were suitable for drawing children's comic books. Would you like to repeat that?
All I said was that, well, when we started Raw Magazine, which was definitely for adults and for rather sophisticated ones, using comics and graphics from alternative underground cartoonists and European artists, well, that was around 1980, and a lot of the artists had safety pins in their ears, you know. But now, 20 years later, they've had kids, and they've had to take those safety pins out and use them for diapering.
In addition to the ex-Raw alumni, we've got children's book illustrators and artists of cartoons and children's books from all over the world, Italian, Dutch, and they've been translated into English. And so this really represents a world effort to put fairy tales into a children's comics form. How did you gather them, Françoise?
Well, some of the artists I'd been in touch with because I'm the art editor of the New Yorker, and I'd already been in contact with children's book authors because they are narrative artists, and that's one of the things that's interesting at the New Yorker, of soliciting and encouraging artists that can come up with their own ideas. They're not so much illustrators as much as they already know how to make up their own story, and that's one of the requirements for a good kids' book. Often is that the artist wants to communicate a story. William Joyce, for example, is one of the most respected of the contemporary children's book artists, and he was interested in the challenge of doing a comic strip. Very few of those stars of the children's book world have ever been asked or have ever thought about doing a sequential narrative with balloons. I was talking to Myra Kalman, who is also a marvelous children's book artist and is doing things for Little Lit, and she didn't even know the word balloon. It's like speech bubbles. I mean, she had to really slow down to do something that would be other than a picture that illustrates a block of text. And it's a very interesting process for an artist such as David McCauley, also one of the most prominent of the children's book artists, who was so interested in the specific challenge.
We taught David McCauley how comics work.
Well, it's very nice because he's done Jack and the Beanstalk, and the beanstalk runs down the center of the page. So as Jack has to scramble up or scramble down, his movement and the growth of the beanstalk is leading the eye up and down the page.
Right, it's
very
is the structure
nice
of the
structurally.
Page. Yeah.
Yeah. And since he is the man who taught me how to build a pyramid in one of his famous award-winning books, I felt very happy that he had mastered the logistics.
Well, when he finished, he said, boy, you know, I teach, and next time I teach, I'm going to teach my kids to do this, because if they can do this, they can do anything. This is so much harder than any kind of illustrating job I've ever thought about before.
Now, I want to take a tour because, well, of course, like any great children's book, children's literature is divided into lands, the way Oz is divided into territories. And so, you know, in this particular book, we've got, among other places, Spooky Land, which is a brilliant drawing by Charles Burns. And it is
Bruegel for kids.
And we also have Dumpty Land, Bill Joyce's cartoon, where I've been chafing to say, since you mentioned him, that the bubbles in the balloons in the Dumpty Land are, of course, egg-shaped balloons. So are the trees egg-shaped. Almost everything else is as well. And then we have in here, we traveled to Japan for a spectacular rendition of an ancient folk tale, The Fisherman and the Sea Princess, and there the colors are the pastel colors of a screen or a fan. And the undersea world that we find there is spectacularly beautiful.
And the style is so knowledgeably studying that Japanese print world and no theater gestures by David Mazzucchelli, who actually had a whole other life as a Batman artist before doing this kind of comics.
Well, what I particularly love, the artist Kaz has made a strip out of an Estonian fairy tale. And what you have here is really Estonia. Estonian spavined horses, Estonian fools, but most particularly an Estonian grandma, complete with babushka and huge sweatered breasts and apron. I feel like she's an ancestor of mine.
Wait, but this is Estonia via Barney Google. This
yes. Also,
and the drawing style somewhere between the old Popeye comic strip and Nancy, and the character you were describing, who, now that you mentioned, does look like she should be from Eastern Europe, is from the Ozarks. I mean, it's this weird version of a character from the Barney Google comic strip. Emma, I think, or whatever the Snuffy Smith's old lady is named. And as
this
a result, this one really...
This shows that the cartoon characters are pretty universal.
Yeah, somebody, I think Maurice Sendak described this as sort of like a hybrid between German Expressionism and Nancy.
Well, it's sort of wonderful because in addition to referring to all sorts of past styles for our adult art historian listeners, there's plenty of things to look and think about here. There is an archive inside each issue of Little Lit, and this one is an excerpt of one of the issues of Fairy Tale Parade. Walt Kelly, the inventor of Pogo, drew the Fairy Tale Parades, and this is the story of the gingerbread man. And this little cooked critter who springs from an oven, one assumes in France, because the workers he passes are named Pierre and Gustave. But where would that be? It must be.
Maybe Sweden?
Sweden?
Or, yeah.
I don't know. But he is the the Pillsbury Doughboy should die of shame when looking at Walt Kelly's Gingerbread Man, because he is so puckish and mischievous and happy to be outdistancing everything chasing him in the strip. Of course, he doesn't really outdo the fox, whose reddish-brown color is just an amazing testament to the skill of your printers. Where was this printed?
Well, it actually was printed in the Orient, but we're working with really a very good team of people who do the communication and the back and forth here. And a lot of the preparation work was done here by our editorial assistant, Nova, and we learned a lot. We had done production on comics.
I should say that Françoise is great at production, really great. Like, I couldn't possibly do the kind of color-separating corrections that she's gotten to totally master because of the work that she's had to do at The New Yorker and beyond. The idea in doing something like this is to orchestrate a whole that's made up of a number of different fantastic solo acts that all can bounce off each other, so that the differences in styles and the differences in sensibility, as well as the different kind of stories, would complement each other and give that feeling of a genuine range, so that you enter into one person's world and then you enter into another person's world, and the whole is a bunch of great worlds to be. I think not only is it showing the kids the stories, but by having these kind of visualizations put next to each other the way they are, it actually is a hint about what it means to enter into somebody's specific brain when you're entering into a story.
I'm speaking to Art Spiegelman and Françoise Mouly. They have put together Little Lit. You're listening to Bookworm, and this is Michael Silverblatt. Now, I want to celebrate one of the strips in particular. It is the final one, and I think justifiably so. It has been done by a woman named Barbara McClintock, and I don't know her work. Can you tell me about
her? She's actually a children's book artist, and over the past 2-3 years, she's gotten, I think, Caldecott Award, and she's working on about 7 books right now. For
she's been gobbled up by the children's book world. They love her stuff there now.
The book of hers that got awarded was also A Gingerbread Man's Story. She is this absolutely rare bird that, in a sense, we've been conjuring up for the past decades where we've been involved in publishing and in comics. She's a woman artist who's a marvelous artist that grew up reading comics and whose lifelong ambition has been to do comics. She has a sense of narrative, and she has a degree of skills that's extraordinary by anybody's standard. But comics has traditionally been a rather male domain. It has not rewarded too many of the artists ever since the heydays of the comics in the 40s and 50s.
Well, this part of the show is, in a sense, a love letter to her, because she's done The Princess and the Pea. And if you remember the fairy tale of The Princess and the Pea, all sorts of princesses are auditioning for the prince, all of whom are declared unsatisfactory by the royal couple. And in the first frame here, we have a flock of princesses that beggar the imagination, except it doesn't beggar the imagination. Here they are. There is a long-necked stork holding her neck regally high, a primping toad looking in her hand mirror, a bull dame in a beautiful green jeweled dress, clearly batting her eyes, a fox looking foxy, and of all the things, the best of all, to the right, a crab, and she's wearing a ruff, and her eyes are on stalks, and her jewelry, maybe it's even a rosary, is dangling from her claw. And oh my, what a spectacular group of regals to be. I mean, when you got these things, I assume that you received them bit by bit in the mail. Did you clap your hands?
Well, what I really loved is that it really evoked, in a very fluid drawing style, the old Grandville drawings. It's a kind of anthropomorphic drawing that isn't what comics conjure up. That's more like the Walt Kelly land of the Okefenokee Swamp. But these seem like very human and with heads that are very animal. Very, mm-hmm. very animal. So that combination, which was once the way one approached this in illustration, is kind of brought back to life here in a very comfortable way and re-entered into the comic book vocabulary.
And of course, you see, the last shall be first and the first shall be last. We have Art Spiegelman's strip at the beginning of the book. It's Prince Rooster, a Hasidic parable. And it's about the joys and perils of being whoever you are, and involves instructive silliness, imitations of animals, nakedness. Now, the Art Spiegelman, who's famously been a provocateur on the cover of The New Yorker, is not in evidence, really, in this book, although I would imagine some crazy critics will think he is. But this is a very, very satisfying and pleasing form of instruction. It's the most instructive comic, I think, in the book.
Well, I always liked Aesop's Fables. On the one hand, it did lead to Mouse, and on the other hand, it's led me toward Prince Rooster. I knew I wanted to do a traditional tale from my ethnic background somehow as a way into figuring this out. And first I thought I'd do these stories of Helm, the nonsense land. And I tried them out on my then 6 or 7 year old son, and he didn't think they were nonsense. They were just fine with him. The way his logical brain worked, all of the things that the foolish people of Helm were up to were totally not foolish. So I dropped Helm and began looking deeper in the tradition and found this parable where I loved that the idea, the story of Prince Rooster is basically this guy thinks he's a rooster, and but when somebody helps him back into personhood, he's told, look, you can walk like a rooster, talk like a rooster, think like a rooster, but just don't let anybody know. And it's basically telling you it's okay to be nuts of a certain kind. So that, I don't even think it's subversive. I think it's just survival skills that
this
are great
to
learn from an old
Hasidic
and told in an old Hasidic tale. For me, part of this whole project came through from the impulse to want to move past irony. And I think one of the main differences between Raw and this, one of the things that is distinguishing some of the other kinds of literature that some of the people we're pulling into the book have moved away from, is to move people past an ironic stance that's kind of permeated the culture. In fact, probably came from comic books through via Mad Magazine in the 50s, but now has become the stuff of which cigarettes are advertised. And here, the idea was to find something one could believe in and tell with conviction to one's own kids.
Well, what I love is that one evening I was at the house of Art Spiegelman and Françoise Mouly, and they were discussing one of the strips. And each, you see, you forget that when you're working on something for children, every choice is a significant choice. And we sat down with an Italian strip trying to decide whether the old women there should be called nags or crones, grannies or nannies, grandmas. What are we going to call this group of three? This is not just a problem of translation from the Italian. This is a problem of spiritual attitude. What are you going to teach the children to call an old person? And what does the good boy call the old ones? And what does the bad boy call the old ones? And since we know the kids are going to imitate the bad one, let's make sure that the bad one doesn't use a word so bad that we have to live with it for the rest of our lives.
Yeah, it's one of the strong determinant of this book, of knowing that at some point there will be kids that will look at it with the kind of attention that you've just given it, you know, because it's something that children can still do that adults have lost the ability to do, which is to totally get lost in a book and get, especially in a picture book, and look at it over and over again. And the kids are the ones, a much tougher audience than the editors or most of the other adults, because they are the ones that are going to find the little things that's inconsistent. They're the ones that are demanding a kind of honesty and rigor in the work. And you can't say to them, oh, well, this was done too fast. It has to have an integrity, and that's such a wonderful goal, to actually be able to do something that will be approved and passed upon by a six-year-old.
We're talking in the Museum of Television and Radio today, taping here with Art Spiegelman and Françoise Mouly. There is an audience outside the studio. I wish that we could hold up these books and let them know that Little Lit will be appearing in bookstores in October, and there are around 17 different features. And you see, one of the sure ways of getting lost in Little Lit is that there are, count them, I believe, 4 different games, and then a board game inside the front cover, which has been designed by my favorite of the younger underground comics designers, Chris Ware. And this is a game which, when you cut out the little cards and push out the little counters, chits, I think he's called them, and assemble the game, you will go around in your little vehicle assembling a fairy tale as you pick up words to the stories and insert them onto your board. So everyone by game's end will have told and retold and rewritten several times a story. Now, of course, some of the instructions suggest that when certain bad occurrences transpire, that you throw the board into the air and pick up the car nearest the board. So sometimes this game gets out of hand. Tell me about the evolution of Chris Ware's contribution.
Well, one thing that I found really interesting is that Chris was the only contributor who's never been a child or somehow never was able, certainly was never able to connect to fairy tales directly. So although we needed to have Chris in the book, he's really one of the great artists around these days. And he was game to try a game, which is what we asked him to do. Knowing his particular graphic skills and the complexity of the way his mind works, I figured he'd come up with a good game. And it was so hard for him to drive into the world of fairy tales. The only way he could do it is structurally. And he's one of the artists. We're talking about finding a neo-sincerity. He's the one who could only get there through every layer of irony that he could travel through. And finally did arrive at something that's quite ultimately to the point. But, for instance, he had a hard time using a simple enough vocabulary to tell the instructions for the game, which make up the back-end paper.
For example, you just described the principle, which is that you put little chits that you have found on the board. And he had the structure, superlative, adjective, noun, occupation, prepositional phrase, verb, adjective, noun, adverb, and denouement. and this is all that he was going to put in. And at some point in a discussion with him, I said, well, rather than put prepositional phrase, could we also color code them so that when they have the purple ones, they put it in the purple slot?
Yes.
And Chris was like, oh, yes, I see that.
Well, you see, I think that in the same way that you will hold your child's hand over the course of living with and reading and learning this book, it's nice to know that art, and particularly Françoise, has held the artist's hands in guiding them to take their work and make it expressive for the children that this book is intended for. I'm happy to tell listeners that Little Lit, Folklore and Fairy Tale Funnies, published by HarperCollins, is the first in what will be a series of Little Lits. The second, I know, will be Strange Stories, a promising threat. And when will that one be out? How often will these be coming out?
It's an annual.
It's an annual. I am talking to Art Spiegelman and Françoise Mouly about the very beautiful Little Lit, their book of funnies for kids. Thank you very much, Art and Françoise, for joining me here today.
Thank you,
Michael.
Thanks, Michael.
I am recording at the studio at the Museum of Television and Radio, and I'm grateful to Ken Mueller, who is the radio curator, for arranging this recording today. Our associate producer is Melinda Siegel. Special production assistance from Alan Howard. Our engineer today is Liz Jennings. I'm Michael Silverblatt, producer and host. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now with Book of the Mouse. Wow.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.